Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, who is the king? Gideon's battle with the Midianites. This is Judges 7 and 8. Growing up in the church, whenever someone would ask kids any question, no matter what the question was, the answer was always God, Jesus. That was what we called the Sunday school answer. Whenever you just automatically assume the answer must be God or Jesus, right? And today, that's what we'll see that happens with Gideon. Gideon's answer is God, but does his life line up with that? And the same with us. Do we sometimes tell the answer we know is correct, but our lives don't line up with that? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Do we profess God to be our king, but not act like it? Do we say that God is the answer? God is the one that we look to. God is the one that we are supposed to serve. God is the one that is supposed to be in charge of our lives, and then live like that or not, right? So this is going to be the question today. So I'm going to go ahead and tell you the story of Gideon and then why that is our question, why that's what we're going to be talking about in our own lives. So if you remember last week, God called Gideon to be the one to free them from the Midianites. The Midianites have been terrorizing them for 7 years, and God has called them to free them from that. And the two sides are camped out. So we've got the Israelites in one camp and the Midianites in another camp. They're about to fight. And then God tells Gideon, you know what? There's too many of you. So this is what he says in Judges 7, verse 2. The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. So God said, you have too many soldiers. And if right now you go and fight the Midianites, you might think that you are so powerful that you were the ones that were able to do this. And so I'm going to start reducing the number of soldiers. And so the first thing he tells them to do is, I want you to go and address the soldiers and tell them, if any of you are afraid, go home now. We don't need you here if you're scared. And there was actually precedent for this. In Deuteronomy 20, God told Moses, when you go to war, tell the people, this is what they are supposed to say to the soldiers. These are the ones that can go home. And one of the groups were the ones that were afraid. And the reason for that is because fear is contagious, right? And we don't want one soldier making another soldier scared. And then quickly, we find out everybody's afraid. We have no courageous soldiers, right? And so God said, if they're afraid, just tell them to go home. And so Gideon does this. This is the first thing that Gideon does, tells them to go home if they're afraid. And he loses 22,000 soldiers. It says there's only 10,000 soldiers remaining after he tells them this. Now, that means over two-thirds of their army are gone. Over two-thirds of the soldiers are scared and they go home. And you would think, first of all, that's a little alarming, although they've been being terrorized by the Midianites for 7 years, so I guess it's no wonder that they're afraid, but that's a little concerning. And then why 22,000 you get rid of? You've got over two-thirds of your army gone. Why is that not enough, right? But God said, 10,000, you might still think that you're the ones in charge. You're the ones that have done this victory. So I want you to further eliminate some of the soldiers. And this is how you're going to do it. You're going to take them down by the stream and observe them as they drink the water from the stream and separate them into two groups. One group of people that kneel down to the stream to drink, and the other group who scoop the water into their hands, stand up and drink it out of their hands. And it turns out that 9,700 of them, almost all, knelt down to drink the water. Only 300 men stood up to scoop it and drank it out of their hands. And God says, okay, I want the 300. That's how many I'm going to use to defeat the people. Send the 9,700 home. And that wouldn't have been the number that I would have chosen, right? And so he sends all of those people home. And now God says, we're about ready to fight the battle, but maybe you're scared, Gideon. Maybe you are the one that is afraid. And being the leader and the one that I've called, you don't have the option to go home. I'm not letting you. But if you're scared, then I want to encourage you a bit. And so if you're still afraid, then I want you to take your servant and go down to the camp of Midian. And I want you to hear a conversation that they're having right now, because I think you would be encouraged if you do that. And so Gideon does this. He takes his servant down to the camp and he listens in and he hears one of the soldiers telling another soldier that he had a dream last night. And in his dream, it was so strange. There was a cake of bread that tumbled down into one of the tents and then made the tent tumble down. And he said, I have no idea why I would dream this. Isn't that weird? And the man said, I think that that bread is the sword of Gideon. And that means that the sword of Gideon is going to attack our camp and send it tumbling down. That's what I think is going to happen. And when Gideon heard that, and he also says, God is going to give them us into their hands. And when Gideon heard that even the enemy knew that God had the power to deliver them into the hands of the Israelites, he was like, all right, now I'm fine. That's all I needed to hear. What a gracious God that he allowed him to hear that he encouraged Gideon in that way. And so Gideon goes back to camp and he says, hey, we're going to be fine. God has given them into our hands. Let's get ready and go down to defeat the Midianites. And he divides them into three groups of 100, and then he hands them a jar that is empty and has a torch in it and a trumpet. And he says, when you hear me blow this trumpet, I want you to blow your trumpet too. And basically just do everything I do and then scream the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. That's what I want you to do. And so they get to the camp about 10 p.m. It says right after the night watchman had changed shifts. That's when they get there. And then Gideon blows his trumpet and he also smashes that jar on the ground. And then all the rest of the people do the same thing. They take the torch out of their jars, smash them on the ground, hold the torch in one hand and blow the trumpet in the other. And then they scream, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." Except they have no swords. This is not their weapon. Their weapon is noise. And it says when they make all of this racket that it causes such a commotion in the camp of the Midianites that they all just begin immediately to just get up and fight. But Gideon has held all of his soldiers back. All they did was make all this racket. They're not actually attacking them, but the Midianites think that they are. And so he's held all of their soldiers back. And since it's dark, they don't know who they're fighting. They think they're being attacked. And so they just hear all this noise and they get up and they start fighting. And what ends up happening is they kill each other. They just begin killing each other until finally, they start running away in all directions. And then that is when the Israelites begin to chase them. And Gideon calls Asher and Naphtali and all of the tribes of Manasseh together and say, you know, let's go pursue these people. And then he calls the tribe of Ephraim and he says, I need you to blockade all of the waterways so that they can't escape through the water. So will you go do that? And the Ephraimites do this and they catch two of the princes and kill them. And after they kill them, they cut their heads off and take them to Gideon as proof. And then they name each of the places that they killed these people after them. And so it says that Oreb was killed at a rock and they named it the Rock of Oreb. And then Zeb was killed at a wine press and they name it the wine press of Zeb. So these are just significant places that they're identifying with what happened there. And Then the Ephraimites go to Gideon and they bring the heads and then they say, hey, by the way, why did you not contact us from the beginning? Why were we not involved in this battle from the start? We've been being terrorized by these people too. And the reason presumably that they weren't involved is because they were too far south and the battle was being fought up north. That would be the reason that would make sense. But Gideon doesn't say all that. He says, hey, what are you upset about? You got in on the end of it. You are participating in the victory. That's the most important part, right? You got that part right. And you were the one that killed two of the princes. No one else did that. So what are you fussing about? And they were like, good point. Yeah, we didn't really have to do all of the hard part and we got the glory. So yay for us. And they move on. Well, then the battle's not over because they've killed the princes, but they haven't killed the kings. And so they're in pursuit of two of the kings right now. And so they go over the Jordan River trying to find these two kings, and they get to a town in Gad's land that is on the eastern side of the Jordan named Succoth. And they say, hey, we've been fighting. We're tired and hungry. Will you give us some food? And Gad said, you're pursuing the kings and you haven't caught them yet? And they said, yeah, we're pursuing the kings and we haven't caught them yet. And they said, all right, well, we'll give you food when you catch them. Your mission's not over and you get no food until you complete your mission, which is so weird. Who knows why they would do that? It seems super strange, but it doesn't elaborate on it. It just says that they did this. And then Gideon's furious. And they say, come back when you've completed your mission. And he said, oh, I'll come back. But when I come back, I'm going to thrash you with thorns and briars. This is verse 7 of chapter 8. And he says, for this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna, those are the two kings, into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Then he travels to Penuel, which is another town in Gad's territory, and asks them for food. And they say the same thing. And then he says, well, whenever I get done with these kings, I'm going to come back and I'm going to tear your tower down. And then he goes and pursues the kings. And it says they found the kings. And when they find the kings, they're unaware that they're there. And it says not only did they find the kings, but they found 15,000 of the remaining soldiers. So it tells us here that they have killed 120,000 have died, and there's only 15,000 left. So almost 90% of their army is dead. They've only got 15,000 men remaining, and that's still way more than the 300 that the Israelites have. It's even more than the 10,000 that they had whenever they told the ones that were scared to go home. And so when Gideon went up that night to their camp and listened in on the man's dream, before he heard the man's dream, he must have been terrified. And it even says they were like the locusts and their camels were unnumbered. It's like there were so many of them, I have no idea how many there were. Well, now we find out that there were 135,000 of them and they have 300. So they're outnumbered 450-1. And so they get to these kings and the 15,000. They don't know they're there. They attack them and it scatters everybody. Everybody runs, but they pursue the kings and they capture the kings. But they don't deal with the kings right now because Gideon still has these two towns in mind. So now that he has completed the mission of catching the kings, he goes back to Succoth. And he captures a young man there and he interrogates the man and he says, I need you to give me names of elders and officials in the town of Succoth because I'm about to punish these guys. And he does. He gives him a list of 77 men. And then he proceeds to go to find these 77 men and do exactly what he told them he was going to do. This is verse 16. It says that he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and the briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth a lesson. Bet he did. He did teach them a lesson for sure. And then he went to Penuel, tore down their tower just like he told them, and then killed all the men there. And so none of that story makes any sense to me. I have no idea why they would turn him down for food. That seems ridiculous. And then this seems like a pretty harsh reaction to that, doesn't it? And, you know, I don't know. I guess if they refused him food, they could starve to death. I guess, you know, that kind of makes sense to the harshness. But I just feel that God probably didn't condone this. It sounds a bit more like vengeance than, you know, teaching them a lesson, as he says. But maybe it doesn't speak to it. It doesn't tell us whether God condoned this or he didn't condone this. And by the way, this happens all over the Bible where it is just telling us what happens. It's not telling us how God feels about every single little thing that's going on because this is a narrative and that's not part of the point of it. And so sometimes it will say things in the Bible and you might think, well, Gideon did that and God didn't say anything about it, so it's okay. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that's why he didn't say anything about it. Maybe he didn't say anything about it because if he addressed every single thing that every single person did, the Bible would be, you know, forever long. And so he just sees no point. They're just telling the story, okay? So I would assume that God probably didn't love this idea, and this is just what Gideon did. Now, this is over, and he goes back to the kings that he's captured, and he deals with them. And so this is verse 18, and it says, he says to the kings, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? And so they answered, they were men as you were. Each one resembled the son of a king. And then he says, well, those were my brothers, the son of my mother. And as the Lord lives, if you would have let them live, I wouldn't have killed you. And so let me just stop for a second and say, we have no idea what they're talking about here. We have no record of this battle at Tabor or anything that, you know, these kings did to people there. The last mention of this is Mount Tabor, where they gathered almost 50 years ago for the battle with Deborah and Barak. But that seems like an awfully long time ago for it to have happened there. And so most likely this was just a town that they terrorized in their 7 years of terror, and they killed some people, and they happened to be Gideon's brothers. And so he's mad about this, and so he takes vengeance on them too. It says that he said to Jether, his firstborn son, rise up and kill these two kings. But the youth wouldn't draw his sword because he was afraid, because he was still a youth. So he was too young. He'd never killed anyone. He didn't want to kill anyone. And he didn't do what his dad said. And so then the kings start taunting Gideon, and they say, rise yourself and kill us. For so as a man is, so is his strength. And so they're basically saying, if you're such a strong man, kill us yourself. Or are you not a man? You're going to get your son to do it. Is that what you're doing? You know, trying to taunt him. And so then he's like, no, I don't have a problem killing you. I was just giving this to my son as his first kill, basically, because he was trying to make him into a warrior or whatever. And so he kills them. And it says, take the ornaments that are on their camels' necks, whatever those were. And we presume that this was just another act of vengeance because he says, I would have let you live if you wouldn't have killed my brothers. And so instead of it being an act of war, which would make sense for them to kill these kings in an act of war, it seems that this was another act of vengeance. We don't know, but it seems as though Gideon, had no confidence before. And now all of the people that God killed has gotten him a little cocky. And he's decided, you know, y'all are in my hands and I'm going to kill you. And he does this. And again, whether it's the right thing to do or not, this is the story and how it worked. Now, after this, the people come to Gideon and they say to him, this is verse 22, roll over us, both you and your sons and your grandsons also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. Now, this is exactly why God wanted to reduce their army, right? So they wouldn't think that it was Gideon or anyone else who had defeated these people. And yet, even though they were outnumbered 450 to 1, don't forget, And God had made it where the Midianites, 120,000 of them, killed each other. They still think Gideon did it. And so, you know, people are just sinful. And they don't recognize God when they see him, right? And so they go to Gideon and they say, "You've delivered us. We want you to be our king." And then Gideon says the right thing. He says, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." So what he's saying is, I'm not going to be your king. The only king that you should serve is God. He is the ruler. He is the one who needs credit for this battle. And I'm not going to be your king. You need to look to God if you want a king. All the right things to say, right? Then he says, "But I would like to make a request of you, that each of you would give me the earrings from your plunder." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites that they had killed. And so they answered and they said, "We'll gladly give those to you." And so they give him the earrings. And it says that the weight was 1,700 shekels. And so this was like 42 pounds of gold that he collected. And it says, with this gold, he made it into an ephod and set it up in the city of Ophrah, which, remember, is the city that he was from. And it says that all of Israel played the harlot with it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his house. Remember how God had told him to topple the altar of Baal that they had there? And he did that, and then he made an altar of God. Well, now he has made a golden ephod. Ephods are supposed to be worn by the priest, and it doesn't seem that he is wearing it as a priest or as a king, but he has set it up as some sort of like trophy of their victory, and now it seems that they're worshiping it. They're definitely being pulled away from God, drawn away from God by this golden ephod that he has displayed as, you know, proof that they have been victorious in his town. So it's kind of like, you know, a trophy of him in a way, right? And so, you know, he doesn't take the kingship. He doesn't accept the kingship, but then he kind of makes himself like this kingly, priestly, you know, authoritative garment made of gold, and then displays it. And then it says that it draws the people away from God. Well, of course it does, right? Because what else is it there for? Then at the end of the chapter, it tells us what happens after this battle. It says that they had peace for 40 years. That's wonderful. But then we hear that Gideon goes on to have 70 sons and many wives. So not what a normal guy does, right? A normal guy doesn't get a harem and, you know, build an empire. And so even though he didn't accept the title of king and he isn't wearing kingly garments, it seems as though he's kind of acting as a king. He's got this golden ephod up, you know, displayed in his city, and he's got a harem and an empire. And so he's kind of acting like he's a pretty important man, if nothing else, right? And then it says that he also has a concubine in Shechem who bears him a son. I'm sure he has many concubines, but this one he has, and he names the son that she gives him Abimelech. Well, you know what Abimelech means? Abimelech means, "My father is king." And so he doesn't take the title of king himself, but he gives the title to his son that his father is a king. So he's calling himself a king through his son. It's like a backdoor way to say, "I am the king, even though I didn't take the title, because that would be wrong, because God really deserves the title. So I'm not going to say that I'm the king, but I'm going to kind of act like the king, and y'all are going to all kind of treat me like I'm the king. And, you know, I'm just going to give a little nod to the fact that I'm a king by saying that that's my son's name." So do you see how he's probably given a lot of lip service to something that is not exactly how he feels inside, right? And so last week, we talked about false prophets. We talked about people whose words might not line up with their lives, right? And these were people that were doing it to deceive Christians, to lead them down the wrong path, to purposefully lead them away from God, or at least that they are leading them away from God by their lives because they're misleading about God. And that's not what Gideon is doing. He's being misleading about himself. He's just giving the Sunday school answer, right? He's doing what maybe we all do in some way or the other. We might want to criticize Gideon and say, how could you do this? You know that you were just an ordinary guy out in the threshing floor, you know, taking care of your grain, trying to keep it from these Midianites, and God took you out of that ordinary life and made you the judge, made you the rescuer, made you the deliverer, and put you in the position that you're in today. You know that. You also know that you doubted him, and he continuously, helped you with your doubts. You know that you were afraid and God helped you not be afraid. You know all of these things about yourself. You know it was all God and not you. You know that God reduced the army twice. You know that you were outnumbered 450-1 and God is the one that beat those Midianites and not you. You know that God caused them to go into a confusion and defeat themselves, basically. You didn't defeat them. They defeated themselves. All of this was of God. You know every single bit of that, yet you say you know it, and then you go on and you act like it was you by putting your trophy in your town. And then you act like you're the king, even though you say God is. And so we sit here and we're like, bad idea, Gideon. That's not how a person's supposed to act, right? But do we do this? This is the question. Do we, when people ask us, are you a Christian? We say, yes. Knowing that that means we are telling people we follow Christ. That is the meaning of that word, Christian, Christ follower. And we say, yes, I'm a Christian. And then do we act like it? Do we actually follow God? Do we actually do the things that he tells us to do? Or do we just believe in him? Do we just go to church sometimes? Do we just pray whenever we need his help? Things like that, right? Do we actually follow him daily? What the Bible says about take up your cross every day, which means die to self and follow me every single day. Do we do that? Is that what we mean when we say we're Christians? Maybe, maybe not. Right? Do we say that God is the king, which means he is the ruler, the one in charge of our lives, the one that is rightfully the king because we know that that's the right answer, but then we don't serve him? Do we say that we're not in charge of our lives because we know that's the right answer, but then we don't do it? We don't follow God. We serve ourselves. We serve our own selfish desires, our own sinful lusts. We do like Gideon, where Gideon goes and gets all the wives and all the sons and gathers this big legacy for himself and takes all the glory for himself and all the pride for himself. Do we do that so that we look good and we don't give God the glory as he is due? Even though we know that he is the one that's due that glory. We know that we are not capable of doing anything at all on our own. Do we act like that? Do we act like we know that God is the one that has equipped us, that God is the one who has saved us, that God is the one that has made us everything that we are, that he's taken us out of our ordinary sinful lives, and he has made us someone important in his kingdom? Do we act like that? Do we act like we are people with doubts who he's encouraged? We are fearful people who he has given courage? Do we act like we know that he has won all of our battles for us? Or do we act like we've done it? When people say, good job, Courtney, you're a great teacher. Good job, whoever you are, at whatever you're doing for him. You do a great job. And do we say with our mouths, oh, it's not me. It's not me. It's all God. It's all God. And then act like I'm pretty impressive. What do we do? Do our actions line up with our Sunday school answer? That's the question. I'm going to read y'all just a ton of verses at this point, just to prove my point, and then we'll basically end. In Ephesians 2, 1 through 9, it tells all the things that God has done for us and how none of this is of us. It says, you he made alive, you who were dead in your trespasses and sins. So you lowly, bad person. He made you alive, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. So you used to follow Satan, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also you once conducted yourselves in the lust of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind. That used to be your nature, children of wrath. But God, who's rich in mercy, because of his great love in which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, he made us alive together with Christ. By grace, you've been saved and raised up together. And he made us sit together in heavenly places with Christ Jesus. For by grace, you have been saved through faith, not of yourselves, that any of you might boast, but it's a gift from God. Same thing that he told Gideon. I don't want any of you to think that this is of you. And so I'm going to do this in a miraculous way. And he did. He saved our lives with the life of one perfect man. All of this is because of him. Everything we are, that he took us out of our sin and made us look like Jesus, righteous and clean, that's all of him. It's not of us. We have no ability to do anything on our own. Philippians 2:13, for it is God who works in you both to will and to do for his good pleasure. It is God who works in you to make you want to do the things that he wants you to do. What a miraculous thing. He isn't forcing us to do the right thing. He's working in our hearts to make us want to do that. That's God. Anything that you do good is not of your own nature, because what do we want in our own nature? We want the glory. We want to look good. In our own nature, that's what we want. We want to get people back for things. We want lots of things in our sinful nature. But God says, I work in you to make you want what I want, to help you act in the way that pleases me. That's me. If you do anything that is out of normal human character, then that's me. Anything that you have the capability to do that in your normal, in your head, you don't want to do, but I give you that power, right? That's God. 1 Thessalonians 2, 16 and 17. Now may our Lord Jesus Christ himself and our God and Father, who has loved us and given us everlasting consolation and good hope by grace, may he comfort your hearts and establish you in every good word and work. May he establish everything that you say and everything you do to make it good. He will encourage you. He will comfort your heart, just like he did Gideon's. We all are fearful. We all are doubtful, and God is the one that works in us to help us, to encourage us, to help us to do the things that please him, to say the things that please him. 2 Peter 1:3, as his divine power has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by glory and virtue. By His divine power, He's given us everything that we need for life and godliness. Everything that we need to do what He's called us to do. 1 Samuel 12:24. Only fear the Lord and serve Him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things He's done for you. After all the things that He's done for you, serve only Him. That's what it's saying. He is the only King, the only one we're supposed to serve. And then Matthew 6:1-6 tells us not to do things for the accolades of men, because if we do, then we've already received our reward. If we want to please God, then we will do the good things without other people knowing them. We will do the good things so that He receives the glory and not us. Because when God receives the glory, when people look at our good works and He receives the glory, then we point them to Him. And that's what we're supposed to be doing if we are doing what we should as Christians. Not for our glory, but for His. Galatians 1:10. Do I now persuade men or God? Do I seek to please men? For if I still please men, I would not be a bond servant of God. A bond servant of God is someone who has voluntarily decided to serve Him. That is what we should be as Christians, those that voluntarily serve the Lord, because He is the King. We don't just say it, we actually do it. We bond ourselves to Him, branding ourselves as His servants. 1 Peter 4:1-5 says, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should have the rest of the time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lewdness and lust and drunkenness and revelries and drinking parties and abominable idolatries. In regard to these things, they think it strange that we don't run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. But they will give account to Him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. And so what he's saying is that now that you follow God, then you are His servants. You are to obey Him. You're not to obey the lusts of the flesh and do all of the things that you used to do. If you say that He is your Lord and not just your Savior and not just a man and not just someone that other people talk about or whatever, if you say that He is your Lord and King, then you have to change your life. Then you have to follow Him, do the things that He says, because He will judge one day. Everyone will meet Him and He will judge their actions and whether they followed Him or not. And so you have to change your life. He said, you've had enough time to do those things that you wanted to do. Now live for God. Last scripture, 1 John 2:16-17. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but of the world. The world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. So, serving God, making Him your King, that is permanent. Serving the golden ephod, being king of your own life, gathering glory for yourself, making an empire, doing whatever it is that you want to do, those things are not going to last. But following God, pleasing Him, you will have eternal life, and those are the things that matter. So, think about those things today. Is He actually the King of your life? Do you give Him all the glory? Or do you like to keep some for yourself? Do you actually serve Him, or do you just say that you do? A lot of times we think that by saying these things, we're actually acting in that way. And we need to really examine our lives and say, am I acting like He's the King? Am I acting like He's in charge of my life? Am I acting like I know that He is the only reason that I'm anything? Do I act like that? or do I just give it lip service? So those are the things to think about today. And next week, we're going to talk more about Abimelech. Unfortunately, he is not the greatest guy. So make sure you subscribe so you don't miss that episode. Also, join me on social media. I'll be posting clips from this and then also verses from what we've just studied today. If you want to read the blog post, you can go to livethroughjesus.com or you can go to livethroughjesus.substack.com. You can read the blog post for free. If you want the written lesson that I just taught in written form with all of its verses, then that is $6 a month or $60 a year, and you can get whatever you want and cancel anytime. So thank you, and I'll see you back next week. Bye.